In February, 47 passengers on a Swissair jet bound for Israel were killed when a bomb aboard the plane exploded. In April, the German ambassador to Guatemala, Count von Spreti, was kidnapped and then murdered. The West German ambassador to Brazil was kidnapped in June and set free only after the Brazilian government had released 40 prisoners it was holding. In August, an American civilian was kidnapped and murdered in Uruguay. In December, Basque terrorists in Spain kidnapped, though they later set free, a German consular official. And in September, the hijackings by Palestinian guerrillas began. One attempt aboard an El Al plane flying over the North Sea was foiled. One of the two hijackers was killed by an Israeli security guard. The other, Leila Khaled, was taken into custody in Britain. This wasn't her first essay in hijacking, as she explained.
I was told that you have an outside mission you have to do. I said, okay, what is it? They've told me that you have to go to Rome and to overcommand a TWA aircraft. I was astonished, really, because I thought that how could I do that thing? But they told me you would be trained, of course. I had not a very long time to be trained for navigation, and then I went for my mission, and it was so easy.
Her second attempt wasn't so easy. But the question confronting the British government of what should be done with her was made immeasurably more complicated by the simultaneous, successful hijackings of three other airliners, with all their passengers and crews. Even so, the Prime Minister of Israel, Mrs. Golda Meir, was adamant that Britain and the other countries involved should not let Leila Khaled go.
People will be set free. What for? I mean, what are they going to do when they'll be free? This young lady will go to a convent. She will get married and raise children. She will go back to her teaching position. She announces. She will do it again.
The hijacked passengers and crew were held first at the airfield, then in other parts of Jordan. The guerrillas' hostages were eventually set free, in return over Israeli objections for the release of Leila Khaled and a number of other Arab terrorists. But blood flowed in the streets of Jordan's cities, thousands died, and by the end of the year the guerrilla movement was more divided than ever and greatly weakened. If the guerrillas had indeed wanted a showdown with King Hussein, they'd had one and lost. What did the king believe were the lessons to be drawn from the fighting in his country?
That it is only through dealing with problems right at the beginning. It is only through organization. It is only through a joint and proper effort, it's only through sincerity, it's only through honesty that such disasters could be averted. As for the sea of blood, it was not of my making or my wish at all, in fact, and maybe some of the people who speak of it are mainly responsible for things reaching this point because they were unable themselves to control the movement and control its direction and control it in every sense and in every respect to serve the cause of Palestine.
The civil war in Jordan was already nearly over when, on the 28th of September, one of the few of the stable elements in all the turbulent politics of the Middle East was suddenly removed. Gamal Abdel Nasser had been a paradox. Adored by fanatics, he himself inclined towards moderation. The hero, even at the end of militant Arabs everywhere, he nevertheless seemed to see that peace with Israel must come. His death not only stunned his people, but frightened them. Without him, they couldn't know what might befall them.
You probably hear the crowd shouting now, shouting their lamentations, shouting, Nasser is good, Nasser is good, we love you, we love you. They've been keeping up this shout all night long, and most of yesterday too.
The death of Nasser brought a momentary calm to the Middle East, as Arab governments and revolutionary movements both licked their wounds and took stock for the future. But the same kind of violence, the same willingness to use the lives of innocent persons as counters in a political game, emerged in, of all places, Canada. In early October, only days after the release of the hostages in Jordan, extreme Quebec separatists kidnapped Pierre Laporte, the anti-separatist Quebec Minister of Labour, and a British diplomat, James Cross. The Canadian government took measures under the Emergency Powers Act, the first time it had been invoked since the war. but they were not effective to save the life of Mr. Laporte, whose body was found a fortnight later in the boot of a car near a Montreal airport. Pierre Trudeau, the Canadian Prime Minister, believed that the kidnapping and death of Mr. Laporte, far from contributing to the disunity of Canada, had brought the Canadian people closer together.
Well, it's with shock and consternation, I believe, that all Canadians have learnt of the death of Mr. Pierre Laporte, who was so cowardly assassinated by a band of murderers. And I can't help feeling, as a Canadian, a deep sense of shame that this cruel and senseless act should have been conceived in cold blood and executed in like manner. And I want to express to Mrs. Laporte and to Mr. Laporte's family the very deep regrets of the Canadian people, of the Canadian government, and our desire as Canadians to stick together in this very sorry moment of our history.
Mr. Cross was luckier. Apparently, he'd been taken by men less fanatical than the murderers of Pierre Laporte. He was held captive for 8 weeks, but finally, in early December, he was released, exhausted but unharmed. Later, he described his ordeal, his emotions under a diplomat's control.
After about 2 weeks, I was allowed, the handcuffs removed entirely, and the chair was moved to the other side of the room in front of the television set, and I spent nearly all day sitting there in front of the television, but without handcuffs, apart from the times when I was allowed to go to the bathroom or to go and wash, in which case I was always accompanied by an armed guard. Saturday was a quiet day until late in the evening when we were watching television. The news came through, first that a body had been found in the trunk of a car at St. Hubert Airport, then that the body was identified as that of Laporte, and later that my own body had been found at Rawdon, north of Montreal. And that, I think, I sincerely trust, was the most terrible night of my life as I watched my death announced on television and feared that my wife was watching it at home.
Violence is endemic in Latin America, but 1970 was no more violent a year than most. Indeed, the most dramatic event of the year on that continent came about entirely peacefully. The election as president of Chile of a middle-aged intellectual, Salvatore Allende, with the support of a communist, socialist, Castroite coalition. Poor men danced in the streets. Many of the rich fled the country. And Mr. Allende was asked how, since the communists were the largest group in the coalition behind him, he'd prevent them from dominating his administration.
Esa es una pregunta que la voy a contestar con mucha tranquilidad, a pesar de que es un poco impertinente.
The president says that he is going to answer this question very calmly, even though he considers it slightly impertinent.
Por dos razones.
For two reasons.
Primero, porque suponer que el resto de los partidos no tuvieran la fortaleza o la dignidad para dejarse avasallar por un partido.
Because it would presuppose that the other parties are not strong enough nor have the will to oppose being dominated or trodden by another party, no?
Segundo,
with the communists.
Segundo, porque el Partido Comunista ha comprometido su palabra frente al país para un programa que no es comunista ni es socialista.
Secondly, because the communists have actually vowed to uphold a program, and this before the whole country, which is not either communist nor socialist. No, they have vowed to uphold such program.
Y tercero, porque el presidente de Chile soy yo.
And thirdly, because the president of Chile am I.
Women were prominent in the tumult of 1970, and not only in Ireland and the Middle East. Some, like Golda Meir and Bernadette Devlin, were prominent in politics. Others were prominent simply as women. For this was the year when the Women's Liberation Movement first attracted the notice of newspaper reporter and TV camera. In Britain, the movement was a much less formidable affair than in America. All the same, the name of the British movement's chief spokeswoman, Germaine Greer, could soon be overheard at almost every London cocktail party.
I do think that women could make politics irrelevant. by us a kind of spontaneous cooperative action, the like of which we have never seen, which is so far from people's ideas of state structure and viable social structure that seems to them like total anarchy. And what it really is very subtle forms of interrelation which do not follow a sort of hierarchical pattern, which is fundamentally patriarchal. The opposite to patriarchy is not matriarchy, but fraternity. And I think it's women who are going to have to break the spiral of power and find the trick of cooperation.
Mr. Heath's new government had come to power determined to do at least two things: to cut public expenditure and to reform the trade unions. No one was more determined to cut public spending and taxes with it than the new Chancellor of the Exchequer, Ian MacLeod. Despite his active political life, Mr. MacLeod suffered for years from the effects of a war injury. He was in constant pain, though he did joke about it.
I have one or two minor afflictions. I have one that I recommend to all aspiring Tory politicians. I find it very difficult to turn my head to the left. After all, if you take people like President Roosevelt, living his life really as a cripple, President Kennedy, with all the agony and torture he suffered with his back, Alec Douglas Hume and everything that he went through when he was ill, these things don't weaken, they strengthen a man.
Mr. MacLeod was a man of unusual courage, but the suffering of years had undermined his health. He was in great pain during his last speech in the House of Commons. He failed to recover from a relatively minor operation, and in July he died, mourned by all parties in the House of Commons. It was left to his successor as Chancellor, Anthony Barber, to announce cuts in both spending and taxes later in the year. Industrial relations, more than spending and taxing, were at the heart of the new government's problems, at least in the short term. Contrary to widespread belief, Britain historically has not been a country with bad industrial relations. In the 50s and 60s, the United States regularly, year by year, lost far more working days through strikes than Britain, even on a per capita basis. But in 1970, the worst that people had been saying all along suddenly became true. Prices rose sharply, so did wage rates, so did the incidence of strikes. More than 9 million working days were lost, the largest number since the year of the general strike, 1926. The teachers, the London airport firemen, newspaper workers during the general election itself, the dockers, the council dustmen, the miners unofficially, the power station workers, each in turn took industrial action in support of their claims. The disputes not only disrupted industry, they brought home the problem more vividly to the general public than ever before. Adverse public reaction, indeed, had a good deal to do with the ending of the electricity work to rule, which blacked out homes and factories and hospitals all over Britain in mid-December. As Frank Chappell, the men's leader, ruefully explained,
"We called off the go slow because the justice of our members' claims were becoming obscured beneath a welter of adverse publicity and irrelevant comment, largely from the Tory benches in the House of Commons. I think public opinion was strong because the action was hurting them, understandably."
The new government came to power determined to set up a new legal framework for the conduct of industrial relations, and the wave of strikes that swept over the country only served to reinforce its determination. When the Industrial Relations Bill was published early in December, the minister, Mr. Robert Carr, wished to set at rest fears that as the result of legal actions under the bill, ordinary trade unionists could find themselves in jail.
"The only individuals at risk at all are the genuine wildcats. That is to say, those who operate in site-induced strikes in defiance of their union's rules and their union's agreements. The union official is absolutely protected in a way he's never been before against personal action. But the real wildcat is liable to personal action. If he were repeatedly, persistently, flagrantly to go on refusing to obey an order of a British court, then certainly he could be fined. And in the last resort, the very last resort, he could go to prison."
Vic Feather expressed the adamant opposition of the trade unions.
"It's an attempt to limit the authority of trade unions and working people, because trade unions, and you mustn't think of them as being separate from working people, they are the instruments of working people. And if this weakens workpeople's claims and strengthens the attitude and the position of employers, then this is a bad bill indeed. I think that this goes marching backwards into time and not forwards.
A question mark hung over the prospects for fundamental change in industry as the year ended. And another question mark hung over the government's plans to renew British arms sales to South Africa. One of the features of 1970 was the mounting impact of hostility here in Britain towards South Africa's racist regime. The year began with widespread demonstrations against the visit of an all-white South African rugby team. Peter Hain, one of the organizers of the demonstrations, was asked whether he thought they'd had any effect.
Personally, I think the effect has been far greater than they've cared to admit. I mean, it's come out a little bit in the last couple of weeks, but I think the mental strain on them must have been considerable because they've been harried and demonstrated against at every point. Virtually their every movement has been covered by us, and this was the thing that we wanted to do. We wanted to use this tour as a springboard for the 1970 tour, and I don't think we could have achieved more in terms of impact.
Did Peter Hain think he and his friends would succeed in stopping the forthcoming South African cricket tour?
I think that the cricket tour, yes, will stop pretty soon after it started, whatever the MCC does, even if it brings in the army. I don't think that they can prevent us from stopping it if they are silly enough to go ahead with it.
Silly or not, the MCC and the Cricket Council did seem determined to go ahead, until, faced with a certainty of having to organize massive police operations to hold the demonstrators in check, the Home Secretary, Mr. Callaghan, virtually instructed the Cricket Council to call it off. Brian Johnston asked Billy Griffiths, the Secretary of MCC, what made the Cricket Council change its mind.
Well, I don't think it was a question of changing their mind. Last Tuesday, they said quite clearly they wanted the tour to go ahead. But when we received, or the Council received, a letter from the Home Secretary, the Council felt that they had no alternative but to accede to this request, particularly as it came from Her Majesty's government.
There must have been one or two people, in fact, you know, quite a few perhaps, who felt this is an awful thing to do to change our decision.
Well, I'm sure we all felt. We were desperately disappointed. I mean, we are cricketers mainly, and we feel about cricket desperately, and we have all along said that cricket is our major consideration or responsibility. These other considerations which have come into it and which have obviously prompted the Home Secretary to intervene are really, I wouldn't say no concern, because of course they're our concern, but you know, they're not our responsibility.
The election of the Conservatives only a few weeks later ensured that controversy would shift towards the question of arms for South Africa. The Labour government had limited its arms sales to spare parts. It refused to sell aircraft, ships and the like, on the grounds that this sort of equipment could be used for internal security. The Conservative government maintained that South Africa needed British assistance in countering an external communist threat. It was this point that was underlined by the new Foreign Secretary, Sir Alec Douglas-Hume.
What is necessary is that the Commonwealth countries should understand that there is a security case for the action which we propose. And of course, if you haven't been exposed to communist pressures before, very difficult to, perhaps, to understand the case projected into the future, but we have to look ahead. We must use foresight. We've seen what's happened in the Mediterranean, and the pattern of the Mediterranean could easily be reproduced in the Indian Ocean. And so this is the case which we put to the leaders of Africa and other Commonwealth countries.
But most Commonwealth countries, especially those in Africa, dissented from the impending change, claiming, amongst other things, that arms sales to South Africa would give that country a new cloak of respectability. An African delegation visited Britain and tried to persuade the British Prime Minister to alter his policy. As the President of Zambia, Kenneth Kaunda, explained afterwards, the meeting with Mr. Heath didn't end any too amicably.
It wasn't the happiest of endings. It would appear to me that the Prime Minister had this feeling, obviously a very strong feeling, that African leaders from the OAU and non-aligned nations were coming here to tell him what to do. I don't know how he got this idea. I tried to explain several times that this, in fact, was not the case, but I didn't seem to be breaking through at all.
So he really had walked out on the Prime Minister.
Well, again, perhaps walk out is not the correct word. I should say that it wasn't a happy ending.
For much of its history, the anti-apartheid movement in Britain had had a faintly disreputable, even way-out air about it. This impression was, if anything, reinforced by the demonstrations over the rugby and cricket tours. But late in the year, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Archbishop Ramsay, visited South Africa and didn't conceal, either while he was there or when he got back, his detestation on grounds of Christian principle of the white supremacist regime. He was under constant surveillance while he was in South Africa. He was asked whether he thought his room had been bugged.
I didn't know whether my room was bugged. It may have been. I wasn't concerned about the bugging of rooms so much as the fact that when one was conversing with people, one knew that one might be putting them at risk for being spied on and cross-examined as what are you talking to the Archbishop about and that kind of thing. What's needed is the removal of the rigorous ban upon the races visiting one another in their homes, joining together at social functions and so on. That separation is carried out with a very harsh rigor indeed.
In an age of almost never-ending violence, when man has an almost infinite capacity for self-destruction, men are still destroyed more by the forces of nature than by each other. In 1970, malign forces of nature reaped a terrible harvest. In March, 1,800 died in an earthquake in western Turkey. In June, at least 30,000 were killed by another earthquake that shook the mountains of Peru, north of Lima. And in December, a twisting finger of death reached out of the sky over the Bay of Bengal and in a few short hours left millions homeless and took the lives, officially, of 200,000 people, unofficially, of perhaps more than 500,000. Brian Barron of the BBC flew over the scene by helicopter a few days after the cyclone struck.
There's a lot of trees uprooted and the villagers on the ground who are standing around near their damaged huts and houses are waving their hands in the air and waving jugs and cans and asking for water, unmistakably demanding water. Obviously, much of their supplies have been contaminated by the sea.
There was criticism, however, of the Pakistan government's handling of the relief operation. Criticism so intense that the president of Pakistan himself, Yahya Khan, replied.
We are a developing country. We are not in a stage. I don't think any country can claim to be at a stage when he's perfect. Nothing is perfect in this world. Within the resources that my country has, within the capacity and capability that my people have, everything possible has been done, is being done, and will be done. It's not ideal, but I would like to know a country which can achieve an ideal.
By the end of 1970, the world had left the Second World War more than a quarter century behind it. Children who had never known the war were now being born of parents who themselves had never known the war. The world's collective memory was fading. And, too, the men who had led the victorious Allies during the war were, one by one, disappearing from the scene. Roosevelt in the 40s, Stalin in the 50s, Churchill in the 60s, and now, in 1970, General Charles de Gaulle. One evening in November, de Gaulle's successor as President of the French Republic, Mr. Pompidou, went on television to tell his fellow countrymen that France was a widow.
Française, Français. Le général de Gaulle est mort. La France est veuve.
Of course, General de Gaulle had long been a thorn in the side of the Anglo-Saxons. He felt he had to be if he was to reassert the greatness of France in a world dominated by America and Britain. He was a difficult ally during the war. He vetoed Britain's first application to join the European Economic Community. How difficult a person General de Gaulle could be was recalled after his death by Lord Avon, who, as Sir Anthony Eden and British Foreign Secretary, had worked with him through the war. Could he recall, Lord Avon was asked, any moments when de Gaulle had been awkward?
Oh, there were so many. I can't recall them to all. There were very many. When we finished, you know, he and I, it so happened that Mr. Churchill was away when he finally came to say goodbye, to go to North Africa to leave our country and to set up his own organization there. He came to say goodbye. And when the conversation was over, our talk was over, I said, you know, General, I must tell you that you have given us a great deal of trouble. Indeed, you've given us, I think, more trouble than all our other allies put together. Then he stopped and he smiled and he said, well, of course, that's as it should be, because France is a great power.